Yankees beat the Cleveland Indians 7-3. Cubs play the Nationals in Game 4 today at Wrigley Field. And in the NHL, the Blackhawks lost to Toronto 4-3 in overtime. Blackhawks play in Montreal tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Tuesday, October the 10th already. Cloudy and windy with seasonal temperatures. 80% chance of rain this afternoon. A high heading 463. Rain showers overnight. 100% chance of rain overnight. 55 for the low. And then a 50-50 chance of rain for Wednesday. Tomorrow's high 63. Here are the new numbers now. The wind is starting to pick up from the northeast at 9. Humidity 80%. 58 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show is next. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Frank Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 45 years ago, and he later served as station manager and one of the hosts of the morning show.
We're going to be talking for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show about, of all things, the Kardashians. And I'm glad we can do so with someone who has explored their story and legacy quite thoroughly in a new book. Jerry Oppenheimer has been a part of the morning show on several previous occasions. He is well known for a number of different books that he has written about very well-known people. A partial list includes Just Desserts, Martha Stewart, the unauthorized biography, State of a Union, Inside the Complex Marriage of Bill and Hillary Clinton, books about Barbara Walters, Jerry Seinfeld, Rock Hudson, any number of other important figures in American culture and politics. And this new book called The Kardashians, An American Drama, published by St. Martin's Press. Jerry Oppenheimer, it's great to welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here again. Thank you.
So, one of the things that intrigues me very much about this book and a number of other books that you write is that often you are writing books about people for whom you are not fans. Let's say, people that you do not necessarily hold in high esteem, and that would.
But I do go into those projects objectively, and I'm not out to solve the world's problems writing about them. With any, I try to be as objective as possible.
Sure,
and I also try to interview the kind of people who have true credibility and not someone who just has an agenda. For example, in the Kardashian book, which was just published, all of the sources are named. They all have great credibility, and they all were part of the circle of Robert Kardashian, Kris Jenner, their children, their spawn. And I think that's important when writing biography, especially unauthorized biography, which does have, it's been attacked as not the kind of genre that has a lot of credibility. It's totally untrue. I mean, when you read a book by a famous person or a celebrity, you're getting one side, and that's it, and it's the side they want to tell, as opposed to my kind of biography, which involves literally interviewing dozens, if not hundreds, of people.
Right, right. And I did not mean to imply by the start of that question anything contrary to what you just stated. My real question was, what is it like, sort of emotionally, to in a sense deeply immerse yourself in the lives of people that in the end turn out, at least in your view, I think in the view of a fair number of people, to not be particularly admirable. I'm just kind of curious on sort of an emotional and more kind of visceral level, I mean, in a sense, what does that experience sort of do to you or give to you?
You know, I think the joy is that I'm a journalist. I'm a reporter. I've been an investigative journalist in Washington, D.C. in my past life for many, many years. And the joy is being able emotionally to tell the real story about the people I'm writing about, whether it was the Clintons or Martha Stewart, and now the Kardashians. You know, you did say one thing that I totally agree with. I was not a fan of the Kardashians. I saw the Kardashians as a family of very shallow, exhibitionistic, narcissistic people with no discernible talent except self-promotion and being famous for being famous and for a sex tape by one of the daughters. But that made it even more fascinating because they have built this enormous, immense empire, generating literally millions of dollars, having major corporations like Sears and other big companies tossing money at them to make deals with them because they felt that with their shallow exhibitionistic, narcissistic ways, they're going to sell product. And for the Kardashians, this has been a gold mine. And it's now in its 10th year, which is pretty mind-boggling.
Right. And so, in a sense, your book is a means by which perhaps we can understand something that, to a whole lot of us, is completely bewildering, if not even a little bit disgusting and deeply troubling.
Yeah, and it says something about our culture that people like the Kardashians, with, again, no real talent of any kind except to make money. And they're not making anything off of my book, by the way. This is one project they're not going to get their hands into. But in any case, you know, my other interest, too, is to find out who famous people really are and go back to their roots and their childhoods and then bring their life forward, which is what this book does. And I found some extraordinary things. You know, Robert Kardashian, the patriarch of today's famous and infamous Kardashians, he passed away in the early 2000s at the age of 59. He had a virulent form of throat cancer, which took him very quickly after it was discovered. He is only known for one thing in the media until my book came out, and that was the fact that he was O.J. Simpson's best friend and part of the so-called dream team that won an acquittal for Simpson in that very famous murder case in the mid-90s. So I went back to find out who he is beyond that. And, you know, I mean, there's some mind-boggling things. One is that the Kardashian family owned one of the largest meatpacking firms in Southern California in Los Angeles, and it was corrupt. And what I discovered in my research, interviewing lots of people and going through public records, was that the Kardashian company was bribing federal government meat inspectors to give them better grades of meat, a better title instead of choice. They would give them prime in exchange for big money. They were actually bribing them, and the uncle of today's famous Kardashians, Tom Kardashian, Robert Kardashian's brother, was arrested, indicted, convicted of performing this paying off these meat inspectors, served under a dark cloud for about 20 years, and eventually got a full and complete pardon from President George H.W. Bush. Mind-boggling. When, after millions and millions of words have been written about these people in the gossip columns and the tabloids, I mean, it's constant, constant, constant. None of that was ever dug up because the kind of smarmy gossip that they've been putting out to the public was more acceptable, apparently, to the media. No one ever dug into who these people really were.
Right. That absorbed all of the attention, all of the headlines.
Exactly.
You say in the acknowledgments that your extensive conversations with Tom Kardashian, who is the Kardashian who ultimately went to prison, and then eventually pardoned. This is really the first time he has spoken.
He didn't actually go to prison, by the way. He made a plea deal.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And he didn't go to prison, but he was under this cloud of a felonious conviction.
Right, right. And this is really the first time that he has spoken to anyone, and we get the impression, especially given the extensive prominence this has in the book, that your conversations with him must have been quite substantial.
Quite substantial. And, he having been Robert Kardashian's brother, having been Kris Jenner's brother-in-law for all the years of their marriage, became an incredible source for the history that had never come out before. Another great source that I had, who dealt with a lot of the issues that have been out there for a long time but actually gave me the true answers, was a minister by the name of Ken Gullickson, who had officiated at the marriage of Robert Kardashian and the woman today known as Kris Jenner, the so-called momager of this crew. And Reverend Gullickson answered a lot of major mysteries that have been out there. One of the big gossip stories has been that Khloe Kardashian, one of the daughters, was not the biological daughter of Robert Kardashian. That there were rumors that she was actually O.J. Simpson's biological daughter, that Kris Jenner had an affair with Simpson because Simpson was so close to that family. And in fact, the minister told me that Robert Kardashian, after his divorce from Kris, had told him that Khloe, in fact, was not his daughter, that in the months leading up to her birth, Kris and Robert Kardashian had not been having a sexual relationship, that there was major trouble in the marriage at that point in time. But Kardashian said that I will not make this into a scandal. I will raise her and love her as if she was my own. So, the fact that the rumors that have been going around for years now that O.J. Simpson was a father, untrue. But what, at least according to what Kardashian told his minister, Khloe was not the biological daughter.
One of the intriguing stories here, of course, is of Robert Kardashian and his connection to O.J. Simpson and the very public role that he played as a friend and sort of informal spokesperson, at least at first, for O.J. Simpson through that entire ordeal. Say a word about the connection between them, the relationship between them, and how that evolved over time.
Robert Kardashian, was a guy of tiny stature. I mean, he was about 5'8", 5'9". He idolized athletes. He idolized football players. He and O.J. had both gone to a University of Southern California, where O.J. was a Heisman Trophy winner. But, in fact, they didn't meet in college because Kardashian was 3 years older. But they actually met in a very popular Beverly Hills bar where both of them happened to be hanging out. They bonded instantly. They were like brothers. And soon O.J. was crashing at the Beverly Hills bachelor pad of Robert Kardashian and his brother Tom. And they just bonded. It was unbelievable. They had businesses together, none of them very successful. For example, they opened a jeans emporium near the UCLA campus. No one was buying the product, but the co-eds were coming to hopefully meet O.J. They had other little businesses. None of them really panned out. And Robert Kardashian really was an entrepreneur. I think the daughters today get their talent in that business direction from their father. And he had a law degree, and he really never did anything as an attorney, but really was actually trying to get into all kinds of business situations. Then the murder happens, and O.J. is charged with murdering Ron Goldman and his own wife, Nicole Brown Simpson. And Robert renews his law NFL license and then defends OJ. It was a disaster for Robert Kardashian. This is another area in which the media has missed the story, because Kardashian lost all of his friends. He lost all of his business possibilities. He was going absolutely broke because people hated him for defending Simpson. It was awful for him. In fact, close friends of his tell me in the book that they believe the cancer that developed in him suddenly, and this was their feeling, was related to all the stress and anxiety and heartbreak that he suffered as a result of, you know, defending this guy who, you know, half of the population of this country felt was that he was guilty, and the other half were thrilled that he was found innocent and acquitted. But it was devastating for the man. You know, people would spit at him in the street. They would throw things at him. The guy was totally heartbroken. Then he got involved with a book project in which he was promised a large sum of money, which, according to the people around him who I interviewed, he never really received. He was hoping that he would be able to parlay that book deal with a friend of his into speaking engagements and being hailed around the country as a hero and a loyal friend. Well, that never happened either. So he really comes out as kind of one of the few heroes of this story and nice guys. He was also a born-again Christian, which is something that has been missed by the media, and he became a born-again Christian after the scandal in the Kardashian family business. He was devastated by that. So it becomes a real fascinating drama about these people beyond just the standard day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year gossip we've been hearing about them.
Sure. And, of course, yes, the story of Robert Kardashian is especially complex, and it ends, of course, very, very sadly. What about the mother of this brood at the heart of the story?
Exactly, Chris Jenner. I mean, you know, the book is divided up into the stories about Robert, the stories about Chris, and the stories about Robert and Chris together, and then on to Bruce Jenner, who was her second husband, and we now know about his secret. excuse me. Chris, just the opposite from Robert Kardashian, came from a very blue-collar family, had no interest in any education beyond high school, and her sole goal by the time she was 15, 16 years old, with the backing of her mother, who had a couple of bad marriages herself, was to marry a rich guy. You know, her first affair at the age of 17 was with a much older professional golfer by the name of Cesar Cernuto. She moved in with him. People from that era who I interviewed, you know, basically said Chris was a gold digger. You know, she was trying to marry a rich guy. She wanted wealth and power and money. And who did she then cheat on during a relationship with a professional golfer? Was Robert Kardashian himself. And then years later, she cheated on Robert Kardashian with another lover who then resulted in Robert divorcing Chris. So her story and the fact that she then went on to become so successful is fascinating on its own.
Absolutely. And, of course, you call into very serious question the memoir that she wrote a few years ago, in which she seems to frame things in a way that that you and many others find utterly dishonest. But I want to finish by asking you about something you say towards the very end of your book, when you tell us that there are very much signs that the Kardashian economy, as you put it, may finally be slowing down. What is the state of affairs as you see it at the moment?
The ratings of their show on the E! Network are dropping slowly. When they now appear on the cover of a magazine, which they were constantly appearing, and it was great for circulation, those circulation figures are dropping. And eventually that show is going to end. I mean, all major long-running TV shows that are popular with the viewing public eventually reach an end, MASH and Cheers and all these others over the years. But Chris has a secret plan. And I spoke with and interviewed a number of people in her business circle who say that she is planning a political career, that once that show ends, she sees herself following in the footsteps of Donald Trump. Both of them have the reality TV DNA. Both have been successful in business. And she says, if Donald Trump can do it, I can do it too. So there's talk that she's been thinking about a congressional run, maybe in California, or a Senate run. And she's a woman who has great ambitions and has a lot of confidence. And she's even talked about the White House, saying that if Trump made it there, she could make it there too. And can you imagine a Kardashian White House?
I cannot. I'm trying not to. at any rate, your book is really quite fascinating, and it's again called The Kardashians, An American Drama, an apt title indeed, published by St. Martin's Press, the author Jerry Oppenheimer. Jerry Oppenheimer, I'm glad we had this conversation. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. The famed American humorist Irma Bombeck once wrote in one of her books about raising children that there is absolutely nothing to be embarrassed about sex, and went on to describe some of her halting efforts to try to talk about sexual matters with her own children. And Irma Bombeck was not exactly alone in feeling a bit squeamish about this topic. Parents across the country, and certainly more so now than was probably once the case, find themselves confronted by a whole host of difficult questions and challenges and choices in terms of exactly when and in what terms to talk about sex with their children. And part of the reason it perhaps is a more complicated challenge now is because we live in a more complicated world without some of the boundaries that once upon a time separated the world of adults and the world of children. One really potentially transformative book, helpful on so many levels, is a book called Talk to Me First: Everything You Need to Know to Become Your Kids' Go-To Person About Sex. And the author of the book, Deborah Rothman, has written extensively on this topic. A former member of the National Advisory Council for Sexual Health, she has been a teacher in the classroom teaching this topic very specifically. Her writings on the topic have appeared in the Washington Post and Boston Globe, among other places. Her previous books include Sex and Sensibility. Again, this latest book, which is now available in paperback, called Talk to Me First: Everything You Need to Know to Become Your Kids' Go-To Person About Sex, is published by DaCapo. Deborah Rothman, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
In addition to what you have written about and the work that you have done professionally on this topic, I really should not neglect to mention that you are also the parent, I think, of two sons.
Two sons and a granddaughter.
So you are writing about this also with that sort of real-life experience in mind. I wonder if you could just say a word about how the personal figures into your understanding of this topic and in the shaping of this book.
I've actually been in classrooms now for close to 40 years, and ever since I've been in classrooms, I've always felt that I needed to give away everything that I was learning to other adults. And of course, I felt that way about my own children. There are certain stories that I can only tell about them when I'm on the West Coast as opposed to the East Coast where we all live. But I have learned so very much from, I think because I'm an educator, what I pay most attention to is how they think at different ages and stages. So my son, Adam, was born in 1980, right before HIV entered the scene. And I was such an observer of what he was taking in from the environment, even as a small child, about this subject, how he was reasoning about it, how he was, the things that confused him in terms of what he was hearing. And I was able to translate that into, okay, so what's the benchmark here? What is it that we need to be talking with kids about even earlier than this? If he were to pose a confusion, that would lay the groundwork so that they would be able to take additional information in as they grew up more easily. So it was a fortuitous bit of timing there. And that's true about everything that touches the kids' lives that I teach and my own children. I'm constantly looking at how they're processing so that I can help adults, as the title of the book implies, get there first. We, as you said before, live in a world where the boundaries between kids and the child world and the adult world are vanishing, and in many respects, they've absolutely vanished. And in order for us to be the ones who set the tone about this subject, in order for us to be the ones that they see as their primary educators, boy, do we have to roll up our sleeves and be proactive rather than reactive, which is really what we've been for generations about this subject.
Absolutely. Can you say a word more about that disappearance of the boundaries? I mean, I think on a very basic level, I think we all know exactly what you're talking about and can only concur. But maybe you can flesh that out for us a little bit. I mean, what are some of the most significant ways in which the boundaries between the world of children and the world of adults simply isn't there anymore? Boundaries which I think at one point you said were once impenetrable or at least opaque.
Right. Well, I would say two things. Certainly the 24/7, 365 cable cycle, where kids can turn on the TV at all hours of the day and night and be exposed to sexual issues. And some of it within the context of news is actually very healthy. But I remember walking into a hotel room, this goes back probably at least 10 years, and turning on the TV. I was looking for the news on a particular channel, and I had forgotten the number. So I was going up and down the channels, and in between, I just flipped through something, then I went right back to it. It was an image of a woman, obviously unclothed, on the ground, with an elephant standing over her, nuzzling her genitals. And I said to myself, this is it, right here. This is the beginning, right? You know, channel 2 is news, channel 3 is news, channel 4 is pornography, channel 5 is news. And that's when I started to really get a grip on this. And, of course, the access to the Internet on a 24/7, 365 basis without and this one I can really sort of lay at the feet of adults. I think it was the gee whiz factor. All this new technology, we come home with our new iPad 2, we're excited, our 8-year-old is excited, we turn it over to them, we leave the room.
Mm.
And we do this even with children younger than 8. You know that TV public service ad that comes on at 11 o'clock and says, it's 11 o'clock, do you know where your children are? And that used to mean, are they home? And if you think about where a child could be with an internet connection up in their own bedroom at 11 o'clock at night.
Wow.
It could be literally anywhere in the world.
Seeing anything.
Right. And this just escaped us.
Right.
I don't know what to accept. Oh, my God, this is a wonderful technology and all the marketing and all of that. And the second piece that I would say is been more deliberate and targeted, and that is and I devote a large part of a chapter on this is the advent of the tween marketing niche. And people use the word tween today as if it's a bona fide developmental stage. And that's pretty horrifying because tweens are children 8 to 14-year-old. And they are being marketed to and have been for over 10 years as if an 8-year-old is the same as a 14-year-old. And the message to all of our kids through marketing directly targeted at them is that, you know what, you're young, but you're really adult-like. You're on the same, like, staircase. You're not qualitatively different, you 8-year-olds, from 14-year-olds. You're just shorter and you have a little less power in your life. But you want to emulate those older kids, and then of course the older kids are emulating teenagers, and teenagers have been emulating adults and been encouraged to by media.
And before you know it, your childhood, in a sense, has evaporated, as you are rushed by the outside world into the next stage.
And the fact that adults don't see this, psychologists don't name this. For parents, I found very little on the internet when I was researching my book about this conversation.
Interestingly enough, your book, which is so much rooted in the modern world as it needs to be, at one point says a word about the Puritans.
Mm-hmm.
You do so partly because you want us to think about the year 2020 as perhaps a year to really try to turn some of these disturbing trends around. And the year 2020, of course, would mark an anniversary, taking us back to the Puritans. Help us to understand our misunderstanding of the Puritans and this topic.
We tend to think of the Puritan as prudes, and the truth is that their ideas about sexuality came from the Old Testament, which are really very sex positive in a variety of ways and way ahead of its time. Therefore, they believed that sex was a gift. It was a very powerful gift, and it needed to be managed very carefully within a relationship, and of course, exclusively a marital relationship. Although they sort of winked their eye at that one too, I think. The heritage that the Puritans have left us with is not sex is bad, although that's what we think. It's talking about sex is bad, and when you think about the fact that Margaret Sanger, let's say a little over 100 years ago, was jailed for daring to send information about contraception through the mail to people who had requested it from her, she was that was against the law. You see it right there. And even in this world where sex in a very sensationalistic and simplistic and titillating way is beamed at our children constantly, we're still a country, because of the Puritans, who, we go to talk to our kids, especially young kids, and these fears come up, this anxiety comes up, and we put it off, and virtually guarantee that somebody else is going to get there first.
Right. You write at one point, our misplaced anxiety about sex education was built into our culture and psyches hundreds of years ago.
Right.
And, of course, most of us walk around nowadays not giving a single thought to the Puritans, and yet in some respects there is that legacy. And as you say, what's unfortunate is that legacy is to a large extent built on a misunderstanding about who the Puritans were and what was important to them. And
right.
And we have somehow oversimplified what they believed, sort of taken the trappings of it and twisted it into what becomes this anxiety that robs parents effective in so many other spheres when it comes to this
right
topic.
Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, in fact, I just posted something on the Huffington Post yesterday about this very issue, that in a sense, we're almost traumatized when we're children. This subject comes up, and suddenly the air in the family, the atmosphere in the family changes. Somebody gets tense, somebody freezes up, somebody stammers, somebody says, isn't it time for lunch? The young child has no understanding of why suddenly there's this threat in the air, and because the parent has given the message, and I don't want to talk about this, they can't then say to the parent, like, what's going on here? So the association between anxiety and sex is built in into culture and is built into many people's psyche about this.
Right. And as you pointed out, it's so odd in this world where anything goes, we can see anything. So on the one hand, we have this openness that's, you know, almost ridiculous in its dimensions. And yet, on the other hand, when it comes down to the simple act of sitting down with your children and talking about these things, suddenly this becomes this forbidden taboo topic. I mean, it just doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it doesn't. It's irrational. And
yeah.
I mean, it's something that's built. See, that's the problem. When something gets built in that early, you don't have the step back to say, now, wait a minute. Is that really rational? And that's what I try to provide. And that's what my writing and my my presentations to parents are all about, is let's step back. You know, we have to step back to see 400 years worth of history to see how ridiculous this is. Give it up.
We're talking to Deborah Rothman about her book, Talk to Me First, Everything You Need to Know to Become Your Kids' Go-To Person About Sex. If there is a central message to your book, aside from the need for parents to feel more comfortable to be able to take control of this, it's the fact that parents who are otherwise perfectly effective in so many other challenges of parenthood kind of fall down when it comes to this. And in its sense, they need to be applying many of the same tools and strategies and attitudes and priorities as they do in other facets of parenthood, that many of the core issues remain absolutely the same.
And again, that you used the word transformative before, and that just made me so happy, because that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to shift, have people shift paradigms. And the new paradigm is, for them, the old paradigm about everything else in their children's lives. And if they will, like, if a child asks a question that throws them, if they will remember, this is what my child does. My child asks questions. And my obligation when they ask questions is to answer the question. They look to me for that. Oh, and this one's about sex. It's the same principle. I'll just answer the question because it's a request for information. And I know what to do with that around every other subject. So one of the things I also say in the book is that this is really a stress response. You know, that when we're anxious, our body goes into stress mode, and the parts of our body that receive oxygen are not the parts of our brain that think of great answers to questions. That's why we freeze when we're taking a test. We can't remember anything, and there's a physiological reason for that. And so that what we need to do is calm ourselves down, calm our bodies down, remember it's only sex. And nothing dangerous is happening here. And see, that's the root of what the Puritans left us with, is that talking about sex could be dangerous. And in those days, it could be. You know, if something about your own sexuality came out in public, particularly if you had broken a rule, you could be shamed. So there was a practical threat then. There is no practical threat now, but our psyches and our bodies act as if there is.
Right. And, of course, your book lines out all kinds of different excuses which parents might concoct in terms of why this shouldn't be talked about. And I think just seeing some of those excuses on the clarity of the printed page might do a lot to shake some parents loose from some of their attitudes. Could you say a quick word in this intensely political year about how politics sometimes complicates this question and complicates our attitudes about what we should and should not talk about and under what circumstances?
Well, of course, sexuality in all respects has been a political football since at least the late 1950s in this country, ever since the Public Health Service decided that they wanted to introduce sex education nationally in the schools because of concern at that point about rising rates of sexually transmitted infections, which back then were called VDs. I believe that because Americans are woefully undereducated about this process, that it became very easy to manipulate the public, and I think that's really what's happened. And sex education itself has been highly politicized. And boy, does that infuriate me. This is not about liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat. Get out of my way here. This is about children and their fundamental needs. It's about child development, not politics. And it doesn't really matter who's president at the time. The decisions that are made by administrations over the years really don't make much sense either in terms of conservative and liberal. Mm. So it was Richard Nixon who decided in the early 1970s that family planning was a fundamental right. Mm. And he is the one who encouraged Congress to pass what was known then as the Tidings Bill to fund family planning clinics all over the country for low-income women and provide some fundamental health care as well. So look at where we are now. Look how things have turned over. It was William Jefferson Clinton, actually, who signed the abstinence-only sex education bill in when he was president.
Hmm. So the political terrain is kind of complicated when we take a close look at it.
Right, and that's because this topic's always being manipulated.
Right.
And hello, kids, where are the kids? And see, that's my job, is to say, get that out of the way. And this is one of the rationales that I speak about in the chapter you were mentioning, is no, this is not about politics. This is about our kids. And there are great Republican parents and great liberal parents, quote-unquote liberal, quote-unquote conservative. And it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with understanding who children are and what their needs are.
Right. Speaking of that, you really build the central core of the book around five principles, five fundamental needs that children have in regards to their parents. And in a sense, it springs from what you describe as an epiphany many years ago, when it sort of occurred to you what makes a child, and what makes the parent, the parent. And
right.
and I mean, that's a disarmingly sort of simple scenario to construct, but so much springs from it, and so much of what you ultimately share in terms of helpful advice springs from that.
Yeah, it really did hit me one day because I'd been working so hard with kids and adults and students and parents and teachers that, wow, it just came to me. This is who children are, and therefore, if we look at what their five needs are, then we get that if they have five needs, we have five jobs, and we truly do. When we are in the role of nurturer, we have only five jobs, and we do them over and over and over. We don't name them, but this is what we do. If I were to leave school one day and do a Q-sort of all the interactions I've had with every one of my students, particularly my middle school kids, they would fall very neatly into these five categories, because when you are nurturing, this is what you do. And so that need number one is the ongoing need for affirmation, to see your child who he or she really is, to understand development, to be able to give them unconditional love for who they are, not their behavior. That's a different story. We don't have to unconditionally love their behavior. To understand how they think at different ages and stages of development, so that we can be there right with them, understanding who they are. That's affirmation. And part of affirmation is validating them as sexual beings, which they are from birth on, in a variety of ways that I go into in the book. And therefore, if we think that by the time, we get around to telling them, that babies grow in the uterus, they've been in sexuality and gender school ever since they were born, observing what goes on around them. Need number two is for information. Just as I said before, it's that simple. This is the time-honored role of adults in young people's lives, is to turn over the wisdom of the ages. Same thing, as I mentioned before. It's our job to turn over to our kids information as much as we can about this subject too, without fear and anxiety, because we have this part of this notion that sexual information is dangerous. It is that, oh, we better keep it away. We better keep it away. So that's, we can't provide age-appropriate information unless we give that up. Need number three is the ongoing need for crystal clear clarity about values. What our kids are exposed to, embedded in those images and embedded in those messages, are the opposite of the values that we want our children to hold dear, like honesty, integrity, caring, compassion, intimacy, privacy. All of those values are transgressed in what our children are viewing in today's world. Need number four is the ongoing need for limit setting that kids need, because that's what keeps them safe and healthy. And if you look at the message that our kids are getting from media, for example, about sexual limits, the message is there are no limits. Limits aren't important. And we've helped create that vacuum by not understanding how to talk to our kids about the vital importance of respecting your own and other people's boundaries. And need number five, because where they're headed eventually is independence, is what I call, what Barry Brazelton called anticipatory guidance, which is we don't just say, okay, you're in the eighth grade now, you can go to parties, without sitting them down and saying, okay, let's talk about this. You're about to enter a new area of independence, and you're going to be making decisions on your own, and we can't turn you over to you around that unless we have some conversations, and that's called anticipatory guidance. So children start out incapable of meeting any of those needs, and so we meet them. But in the process of meeting them, we teach them how to meet those needs on their own. And when they can do that, then they're adults.
And, of course, part of the message of your book is that parents are already doing this. That is, these five fundamental needs of children play out in all kinds of ways, not just in the talk about matters of sexuality, but in every facet of parenting. And parents so often will do a fine job of it, or, you know, very fine, or feels like a fine job when it comes to other matters. When it comes to this topic, for some reason, these five fundamentals sort of go out the window, as well as all the tools which parents use with great effectiveness in other areas. There's no need for this breakdown to occur when it comes to this topic.
See, and that's the transformational part, and it's really not that hard. Because the big secret here is there's no secret. Right? The big secret to doing this job well is the fact that good parenting is good parenting is good parenting is good parenting. And follow what you do always, and you'll be doing it.
I appreciate also the kernels of great advice that are found in this book. Things like the parent needing to become more askable, more approachable, that they not be afraid to initiate conversations and not just, you know, wait for these conversations to be initiated by the child, but sometimes taking the reins, and many, many other such points of discussion. And I should say, as someone who is not a parent, except the two golden retrievers, I found your book really, really interesting. I mean, I think even somebody who is not yet a parent or is sort of done with this phase of parenthood, I think all kinds of people will find this a really intriguing book. And even if one is not all that concerned about this particular topic, I think it opens up a very, very good sort of process of reflection on what good parenting is all about. So,
Thank you so much. Music to my ears.
Let's remind our listeners of the book. It is Talk to Me First, Everything You Need to Know to Become Your Kids' Go-To Person About Sex. This is now a paperback from Dacapo Lifelong Books. Deborah Rothman, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I enjoyed this.
And I wonder if I might mention my website.
Absolutely.
Where there's information about the books and also links to lots of other articles that I've written. It is Talk to Me First, but it's Talk and then the number two, not the word two. Talk2mefirst.com.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD.